pandemic or no pandemic, the taps are flowing once again at Florida bars and night spots. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, what does the reopening of the state's bars this week mean for business and public health? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, the Jacksonville Symphony is also opening its doors, performing this week at Jacoby Hall, a couple of concerts, and they're letting you, the public, in for free. We'll tell you about it. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. There are now nearly 664,000 cases of COVID-19 across the state of Florida, with more than 12,000 deaths. 544 are reported dead in our area of the First Coast so far from coronavirus. Now, despite the scientific community's fears of that rising death toll, Florida has been moving vigorously to ease restrictions on schools and businesses. The latest iteration of that, Florida bars. They can get the taps flowing again today. Halsey Bashirs, the secretary of the state's Department of Business and Professional Regulation, says he's now rescinding an emergency order that prevented on-site consumption of alcohol at the state's bars in this pandemic. Now, what that basically means is bars around the state today are being allowed to reopen at 50% capacity. Bar owners had sued the state over the earlier lockdown orders. So what does this mean both for this business sector and also the potential spread of coronavirus? On the line now, we welcome two local business owners, Hannah Ferguson of the Volstead in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you back on the show. Also on the line, Corey Adams, the co-owner of Southern Swells Brewery in Jacks Beach. Hey, Corey.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And already getting your calls, let us know your reactions to the reopening of Florida bars across Florida today. At 50% capacity, it's 549-2937 to call us up. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we're already getting your Facebook comments as well. Hannah, let's begin with you downtown at the Volstead. How have you been getting along, keeping your doors open with the emergency order? And what does the change mean for you today?
So we've actually had to acquire a 509 food license, like many other bars that we've known in Jacksonville. So we've actually been open for the last 2 weeks, technically as a restaurant, serving a variety of different frozen foods. The only requirement we really had to do was, you know, install a microwave. So things have been going pretty smoothly. We've still been following all of our CDC guidelines. But it really is good to be open again.
So what this will mean then for you is you can now open your doors to more people since you already had people in the Volstead. Will you be allowed to let a few more people in?
I mean, we're still going to be regulating the amount of people that come into the bar. Safety is our number one priority. So it is great that, you know, they're allowing a 50% capacity for bars, but we're still going to make sure that, you know, if we are reaching 50%, that it is still in, you know, safe, socially distanced manner.
Corey Adams, the co-owner of Southern Swells in Jacks Beach, your situation has been about the same, hasn't it? You started selling Hot Pockets on site so that you could open your doors. Is that right?
Correct. So, yeah, we're pretty much in the same boat as Hannah. It's been about 4 weeks that we've been open. But same thing, had to go the route of the food license. And yep, we also went with frozen options. You know, I think similar to the Volstead, I don't think either of us had any intention of being a restaurant. So for us, we just tried to do the least expensive option to satisfy the requirement and get the doors open.
Okay, so now with this emergency order being rescinded, what does that mean for your brewery? What changes will people see, or will things be business as usual?
Yeah, there really won't be any changes. Right now, we're still at the 50% capacity that we've been able to operate at with the food license, so nothing really changes from a capacity standpoint. And because of the unsurety of the future, we're going to go ahead and keep our food license and kind of keep operating under this this model until a later date. If we see a point in the future where we don't see food being a requirement for us to stay open or stay at the maximum allowable capacity at that time, then maybe we'll get rid of that license and go back to normal.
We'll go to your calls in a moment as bars reopen at 50% capacity across Florida. As we're hearing from the owners of the Volstead and Southern Swells Brewery, they have been open for a few weeks already at 50% occupancy because they've been selling just a little bit of food to get around state emergency orders on bars. What do you think about this? It's 549-2937 to join us. And Hannah at the Volstead, let me get your reaction to this. Of course, as a business owner, you're concerned about your bottom line. You want to stay open. That said, epidemiologists have been warning that opening up bars is a bad decision from a public health standpoint because it's difficult to keep people who are drinking 6 feet apart. Florida is a hot spot, remains a hot spot for coronavirus. So what's your response to those who are worried this is a bad public health decision?
I mean, there's a lot to consider, especially as a small business owner. I am just the marketing and events director, so I've been working alongside with our owner and just trying to, you know, see what will help us keep our business alive because we are a small business, but also making sure that if people do want to come outside and come have a drink, that we are doing it safe and effective. And it's a matter of, you know, just people who do come into our bar and implementing those rules. And if those who don't want to follow along with what we've implemented, then, you know, we would have to take action.
Corey, what about you? I know at Southern Swells, you have been enforcing social distancing. But the fact of the matter is whether it's at your establishment or any other, when people are eating and drinking, they're not wearing masks for the most part. So, you know, there will be some spread of the disease at businesses like yours around Florida. I think that's a fair assumption to make. So what's your response to these concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a concern with any business, not just respective to bars, breweries, restaurants, things of that nature. I mean, anytime there's going to be people congregated in the same area, there's obviously the, you know, the risk of spreading the disease further. I mean, I think a lot of the responsibility lies on business owners to set proper policies and procedures. And then the second part is, you know, relying on patrons to respect those rules and follow them. And, you know, I think we've proven, and many of our colleagues that have been open have proven, that we're able to do this. And I would imagine if you walk into Southern Swells or the Volstead on a busy night, you'll see that groups are, you know, by themselves, grouped together, and are 6 feet apart from other groups. So when you are sitting there with your mask off, you know, consuming food or alcohol, you're doing it with the group of people that you came there with, and you're 6 feet or more away from any of the other patrons in that establishment. So I think as long as we can all kind of commit to that and follow the rules, and patrons of these businesses are able to do the same, I don't foresee it being any bigger risk than any other industry.
You're not worried about a patron suing you, maybe saying, I'm pretty sure I got COVID at this place because there were this many people and et cetera, et cetera. You're not worried about that?
No, because, I mean, we're going to follow every single guideline that's put forth. So, you know, if we're following all the state and city and federal guidelines for the virus and how we're supposed to act, you know, I don't think we're at any greater risk than we are any other day that we're open.
Let's go to your calls now as we speak with two local bar owners. As the state opens taps again around Florida beginning today, now, a number of tavern owners have been able to keep their doors open for weeks now because they've been offering cold sandwiches or hot pockets to get around the state restrictions, which didn't impact restaurants that served food. What are your thoughts? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Alex is in Orange Park this morning. Hi, Alex. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just want to say that I think this is a very positive step for the state of Florida. A lot of people don't realize just how much this affects everyone economically. We're starting from, like, the manufacturers, you know, down to the vendors, down to the owners, staffing, entertainment. You know, all of this needs to start ramping back up. Florida, unfortunately, or actually Jacksonville, it's a drinking town with a sports problem. And we really need to have, you know, some kind of life again back in this state. Me, myself, I've worked in the nightclub business since I was 19 years old, and I'm 43 now. And let me just tell you, as an entertainer, I miss it, and I'm glad this step's taking place.
Thanks, Alex. Hannah Ferguson at the Volstead. Certainly that is the sentiment that's shared by everyone in your line of work. You want to get back to business. You want to give people an opportunity to get together and socialize. That said, I want to read you this tweet from a listener. Alexis tweets the show, "I don't want to see anyone's business fail, but we saw what happened last time bars tried reopening. This isn't safe for the people who work there or for the patrons." So what's the plan, Hannah, if everybody kind of reopens for a bit and then everyone has to shut down again because we just see another huge spike in COVID cases?
I guess it really depends on how that bar is being managed. Even the first time when we were shut down, we were still following all protocols. So I really feel like it's a case-by-case basis as far as how bars are handling the situation. And I know for us personally, we still did everything that we were supposed to do. So in a sense, it wasn't fair for us having to be shut down because other bars were not following the rules.
Corey Adams of Southern Swells, do you feel that bars were unfairly singled out when it comes to the state emergency orders, that the restrictions on your sector were stricter than they were on, say, restaurants?
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt. I think what Hannah just said is perfect, is that, we were following all the guidelines and others weren't. And it's a shame that the entire industry was judged based upon the few bad apples, to use that term, that were not following the rules, were packing people in elbow to elbow, not enforcing any sort of social distancing. And yeah, of course, that's going to lead to a spread. I mean, that would be the same as, if you pack 100 people into a conference room or something like that at a business. So it was really unfortunate that the entire industry was penalized because of the actions of a few. So my hope is that this time around, there is more enforcement, so that the businesses and bars, restaurants, breweries that are not following the requirements are penalized and shut down rather than the entire industry being punished.
Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Two things. Number one, I just think the bar owners should not be held liable if somebody happens to come down with COVID. If you want to go to a bar, then I think you just ought to accept the risk that is inherent with going to a bar at this particular time. But I would not hold any bar owner responsible if I went and I happened to catch something. And number two, I was just kind of curious this weekend about how other countries were dealing with this kind of opening in social atmospheres. I found a webcam in Rome, Italy, and I watched at night as people were packed into this center market in a city. And they were, you could tell on the webcam, they did not have masks on. They were in big groups. They were sitting at all the tables outside. There was no, distancing whatsoever. And they were just going about their day. Now, there could be risk associated with that, but let things open up and let people accept the risk. That's just my comment.
Mark, thanks for that. Hannah Ferguson, are people being asked to sign waivers at any different establishments that they go to? I haven't heard much of that, but what about his comment that if you go out and you socialize in groups, and particularly if you don't distance and wear masks, you're taking the risk on yourself, and you shouldn't be able to sue an establishment when you know that this could be a risk to you?
I mean, stepping outside of your door is a risk every day now. So I do think that people who do plan to go outside or go to a bar or a restaurant, they are taking a risk, but they also need to really consider, how they're feeling as well. So, and also how they interact with people around them. So, I mean, we're taking a risk at being open. The patrons are taking a risk at going outside. It's all a matter of us trying to be a little bit more responsible in how we care for ourselves and also how we care for others.
Here's a study our director, Josh Torres, just referenced for me to mention. As we all start going out again to restaurants, a new study from the Centers for Disease Control published last week found that adults who tested positive for COVID-19 were twice as likely to have eaten at a restaurant within a 2-week period before getting sick. They say not being able to wear masks while eating or drinking and the restaurant's air circulation may be factors. So Corey Adams at Southern Swells, that goes for a brewery like yours as well. Just from everything we know about this virus, from everything we're hearing from public health experts, whether it's Southern Swells, the Volstead, a restaurant at the St. John's Town Center or the beach or downtown, wherever you go, you are assuming a risk if you go out to eat or drink at an establishment. People need to be aware of that. And so what are your customers saying to you about this?
Yeah, I mean, I really disagree with what Hannah said. Like, you're taking a risk by stepping out of your house if we're going to look at it that way. I think there's risk inherent anytime you're around people that are not within your own social group. So whether that's the grocery store, the doctor's office, the gym, you know, wherever you could possibly be in public around people other than yourself and your family that you've been quarantined with, you're taking a risk. So I guess I don't really know how to comment on that side of it. I would say from our guests, we have not, you know, if they're out coming in and visiting our place, they're obviously comfortable with the risk level that they're assuming. So we haven't really heard anything negative. I will say we have received a lot of positive feedback on the way that we've handled things both now and in the past, as far as creating an environment where people can come in, enjoy a beverage and feel safe in doing so. So I do take a lot of pride in that and feel that we've done a great job. And having visited quite a few other establishments in the city, I haven't really seen any bad examples where they are not following the guidelines that are set forth by the state.
All right. And on Facebook, a listener writes, we should all be fighting for better support from our local, state and federal government to get through this pandemic. I don't want to see businesses close or see people get sick and die. Hannah, we interviewed you several months ago when this pandemic was first beginning, and your business, like so many others, was struggling. It's been tough for so many small business owners. Everybody wants to get back to normal. We are, though, being forced into a series of difficult choices. Everybody is, whether you're a business owner or not. What's the strategy for the Volstead as these restrictions ease? How have you made it this far, and what's your plan for the rest of the year to continue to stay afloat?
I think it's kind of what Corey had mentioned earlier, as far as, you know, keeping up with the current licensing that we have as a quote unquote restaurant with our license and keeping our microwave installed. I mean, we're still wearing masks. We're still, regulating who comes, like how many people come in and distancing them. We have, you know, hand sanitizer at every table. So we're still following everything that we have been following since the beginning. And we don't really plan on making any major changes until, really, honestly, we don't even have a timeline for that.
Yeah,
it just depends on what happens in the future.
Right. And Corey, now, as I mentioned a minute ago, at Southern Swells, you started selling Hot Pockets to get around the essential shutdown of bars that didn't sell food. Now that those restrictions have been eased in Florida, will you continue to sell food?
Yeah, at least for now. I think we'll evaluate this decision, you know, whenever there's a new change in the rules and the guidelines that we're following, you know, whether it's when things go back to 100% occupancy and we're all kind of back to normal, to use that, you know, that phrase, I think we'd probably evaluate at that point, see if we have any interest in keeping it. But at least for now, while we're still in uncertain times and there's really no end in sight, we're going to keep that license and give us the flexibility of having to pivot back on that if there's further restrictions down the road.
We should note, too, that this isn't monolithic around the state. Bars in South Florida, particularly Miami-Dade and Broward counties, remain closed. Hannah, you know, what we're dealing with in Jacksonville is a little different than other parts of the state, which have seen an even higher death toll from this disease. So, your thoughts on that, on how this area differs from other parts of Florida?
It depends on the location. I mean, for us specifically, just in downtown, I mean, a lot of businesses are still closed. A lot of people are still working from home. So our crowd control is not really that big of an issue versus, you know, Miami. It's definitely more populated down there. There's definitely a lot more bars to consider down there. A whole different ball game for Miami, and I really feel for them. It is unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, it's a reminder, Corey, that this pandemic is still with us. We've started to see a slight downward tick in cases, but as I mentioned at the top of the hour, more than 12,000 people have died from coronavirus in Florida alone. That's more than entire countries in other parts of the world have seen in terms of a death toll. And so we are not out of the woods yet. If you're ordered to shut down again at some point, are you prepared to do that?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, we, you know, I think this whole industry has proven we can adapt to whatever is thrown at us. And, you know, I think the big thing for me going forward is I hope any future restrictions or, you know, further reopenings are done in a consistent fashion. You know, it's unfortunate that bars and breweries, although we're following all the guidelines of restaurants, we're not, we haven't been treated the same way. So I would hope that
And let's explain why. Can you explain why the state decided bars were a particular risk as opposed to restaurants? There's just something about the way people congregate in bars that's special.
Quotes I've heard from Mr. Beshears or the governor, it's, you know, the thought process, at least in what I've read, is that places that are not serving food are essentially offering a greater opportunity for individuals to get intoxicated and make poor decisions about social distancing, I think was the reasoning behind it.
Yeah.
I'm not buying that, you know, maybe for some bars and some breweries, but, you know, speaking for myself and also having been to the Volstead before, I don't think these are the kind of establishments where people are going and getting, you know, trash and making poor decisions. They're enjoying craft cocktails or in our case, craft beer. And most cases are doing it extremely responsibly. And, you know, I really don't see any greater risk than there would be at visiting a restaurant and ordering a margarita.
Well, I want to thank you both for your thoughts this morning. Hannah Ferguson on the line from the Volstead in downtown Jacksonville. And also with us, Corey Adams of Southern Swells in Jacksonville Beach, as bars reopen around the state today at 50% occupancy. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead. Meanwhile, later, more on the Jaguars' victory at home against the Colts during yesterday's home opener. The only one in the NFL that had people in the stands. That's coming up. And up next,
we're there really to help with academics, behavior, and attendance.
How Cityear is working with students this term in the Duval County Public Schools amidst the pandemic. All of that ahead, but first, here's how you can support WJCT.
By giving us a call at 353-9528 is the way to do it. Thank you, Melissa. This is such a great program. It's been on the air for years because of listeners just like you participating and calling in every day and making us the one stop for what's going on in Jacksonville, whether it's culturally or politically. Melissa's here every day taking your calls and bringing you the newsmakers of the community so that you can be well informed. Why don't you take the time now to give us a call at 353-9528. This is the beginning of our fall pledge drive. We're not going to interrupt the programming. We are just going to come in here where we would normally run a promo. So this is your chance to give us a call at 353-9528. Do it now. You'll be glad you did, and you will make sure you help sustain this program well into the future. And, of course, sustainers are our most reliable source of revenue. So please consider becoming a sustainer today. Or if you're already a sustainer, give us a call, and maybe you could do a one-time gift of $10 or $100 just to help us meet our goal on this fall fund drive. Thank you so much. Turntable Tuesday can now be heard on Anthology on the WJCT app and 89.9 HD3. For the best on vinyl, listen to Anthology Tuesdays at 9. Turntable Tuesday, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
I'm Robert Scott. I've been a sustaining supporter of WJCT for over 10 years now. I listen to WJCT all the time, and I have since I was a young adult. One of my favorite shows is actually a local show, and that's First Coast Connect. One of the great values, I think, is listeners are invited to call in. By the end of the hour, I'm definitely more informed about an issue. It's also made me think about it a lot deeper than I probably would have. This is WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World brings you more than just a day's news.
Well, the poor old British pub has been around for 2,000 years.
We introduce you to people around the globe.
I'm a Liberian, but I'm part of Africa.
If we were only in Argentina.
I think it's a Scottish thing, you know? This sense of doom there, but it's always kind of amusing to us.
Join us and hear The World. Weekday afternoons at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, as more students return to area classrooms this week and next, the AmeriCorps members of City Year will be back in school with them. They've adjusted their service model to hybrid classroom instruction and are trying to help teachers undo any learning loss due to COVID-19. So how does City Year work in the Duval County Public Schools? Here's my conversation with their impact director, Alexis Holton. Hi, Alexis. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Really good. So this school year is certainly interesting for everybody, parents, teachers, and students and staff. Tell me a little bit about how City Year in Jacksonville is providing support to the academic world as we try to make sure kids learn, but also stay safe.
Yeah, so City Year's work remains constant in the schools. We're there really to help with academics, behavior, and attendance. Right now, in the time that we're serving, we're doing that in two ways. We're doing that in the classroom while staying socially distant. We're still providing that support to students. We're helping them with their academics. We may be giving them a little bit of coaching around behavior. We're making phone calls home for those who haven't started coming back to school yet. And then we're also supporting in the virtual setting of Duval Homeroom, where we log in beside a teacher. We help the teacher facilitate their class sessions. We may be sitting in the background answering the chat. So if students have questions and the teachers say instructing whole group, we can answer those. And then we can also have one-on-one or small group sessions in those virtual breakout spaces in the classroom setting. So our work remains very consistent, as it always does. It's just we've had to modify some of our work, obviously, just to maintain certain distance practices and ensure that our students are still being able to be connected to us.
Right. And let's talk about City Year for people who aren't familiar with it. It's been around for decades now, and you bring young adults from diverse backgrounds into schools for a full year of community service. It's grown all over the country, including here in Jacksonville. And the model is one that is helping high schools and other grades increase graduation rates and increase academic performance. Can you explain a little bit about how the City Year volunteers work?
Absolutely. So our volunteers are members of AmeriCorps. They actually sign a one-year commitment to our program. They go into schools all across the country. And they work as near-peer coaches or student success coaches to students who may be struggling academically, who may need extra support social-emotionally, or, again, in that attendance area. So we have a diverse group of volunteers, ages 18 to 25. They come into schools. They're the first ones there. They're some of the last ones to leave. So they're serving in the schools every day alongside their teachers, in the classrooms, providing that additional layer of support. We know that sometimes there's a lot of students in the class, and we want to make sure that we can provide that extra layer to those that need extra attention. So our members work closely with certain students throughout the year. And then in the after-school space, they also push into those spaces where we can do some tutoring and, you know, some of the other programs that are run at schools. We plan events for whole school, whole child, which is our model. So if we're wanting to increase attendance maybe throughout all of sixth grade, we may say anybody with attendance, perfect attendance for 30 days, we're going to throw an ice cream party. So that's more of a whole school event versus when we're one-on-one or in a small group setting in a classroom working on some of those academics, maybe giving them an enrichment class or building a skill they may be deficient with.
And this is such a challenging time for students and teachers. So I would think every little extra bit of support is very much appreciated right now. So what kind of feedback are you getting as the school year gets underway?
So we've been very fortunate here in Jacksonville. We have a lot of support from our school leaders and our school partners, principals, teachers, students, parents. They're always rallying behind us, always wanting us on campus. They just feel the presence of our red jacket. So we hear a lot of that in our school meetings, you know, alongside principals and some of the district administration, just the support we give. On a more ground level, you know, when we're making phone calls home, we get to sometimes connect with the parents, and the parents just appreciate us taking the extra time to connect with their student or help them out on maybe a homework assignment they've been struggling with. And student feedback is always positive. Students love our City or AmeriCorps members. That near-peer model really helps them.
Near-peer, so they're young adults, so they're almost peers. Close in age. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely, that 18 to 25 range. So there's just some closeness and relation that they can connect with a core member because they're not that far removed from when, you know, maybe they were in middle school or high school. And so our students are always looking for our members. They're always, you know, writing thank you cards or saying, hey, the only reason I came today was because I wanted to talk to you, right? So we're able to build really good connections with students, and we get their feedback. They also love it when they're able to score high on an exam or pass maybe a certain unit assessment in their class, and they really feel such pride, and then they thank their core members, thank you for helping me understand this material. So we're very fortunate that we have positive feedback from students, from our families and parents, and then the actual school leaders themselves.
And City is in how many Duval schools now?
We are in 12 Duval County public schools. We are in 2 high schools, 3 middle schools, and currently 7 elementary schools.
Well, it's going to be a challenging but unforgettable school year. So thanks for sharing this with us, Alexis. As City Year is in the classrooms across the county, as the academic year gets into full swing, she is Alexis Holton, Impact Director at City Year here in Jacksonville. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the Jaguars kicked off their season at home Sunday against the Colts and beat Indianapolis 27-20. Very exciting, but before we get into the big victory, let's talk about how this was a COVID-proofed affair. WJCT News' Sky LeBron is here now. Hey, Sky.
Hey, how's it going?
Good to see you. So the Jaguars were the only NFL team who took the field yesterday that actually had fans in the stands, right?
Yeah, there was a ton of games played yesterday, and Jacksonville was the only host city that had fans at 25% capacity. Kansas City had allowed fans in their opening game, but that was back on Thursday. So it was the only game played Sunday that allowed that. And overall, they didn't sell out. There were still tickets available. And when you had to buy tickets, you had to buy them in pod form, meaning you would buy them with 2 seats, 4 seats, 6 seats, or 8 seats. It didn't look extremely crowded, but there was one big benefit, and that's authentic fan noise. A lot of the other games that you would watch yesterday, they were pumping in fake crowd noise, and Jacksonville is one of the only places that you can get some real fans screaming.
Right. I saw some coaches telling their players, you've got to bring your own energy. Because you're not going to be able to feed off the crowd.
Yeah, and it's big for football, too, because you go into different stadiums where there's just tons and tons of crowd noise, and it really affects how you're able to play the game, how you're able to give signals off to your other players. So that's a big thing that I think all teams are having to adjust to.
Now, with 25% capacity in the stands, what were some of the other measures the team took to protect the players and the fans against coronavirus?
Yeah, before the season, the Jaguars let in a lot of media, so I did a walkthrough of the stadium, and there were a lot of measures that were put into place. Ticket sales and concession stands, all that can be done without touching anything other than the food or anything else that you're trying to buy, an item. There's a mask requirement at all times, including when people are in their seats, and there was compliance officers walking around to make sure that people were actually following those guidelines. most of the seating and arrangements inside of the stadium, other than the seats for the actual game, were taken out so that people can't just kind of loiter around inside or just wait around and create some potentially dangerous situations. There's also a bunch of signage everywhere for social distancing, and they added over 750 hand sanitizing stations throughout the stadium.
All right. Now, of course, beginning this season, the NFL is kicking off each game with the so-called Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, composed by Jacksonville's own James Weldon Johnson. And it's one of many nods the league has given to the Black Lives Matter movement. How did the Jaguars approach that with the national anthem portion of the game?
Well, I think it's a little important to bring up something that happened before. This weekend, the Dolphins released a video stating that they were going to remain in the locker room for both Lift Every Voice and Sing, as well as the national anthem. And then they, in the video, they described what they want to see change, how they haven't seen things change, how it seems very empty, so they're going to remain in the locker room. The Jaguars decided to do the same thing, and they, while the Indianapolis Colts were out there, they were out there for both Lift Every Voice and Sing and the national anthem. The Jags weren't. They remained in the locker room. They released a statement before the game saying that this was their way of showing unity among the team, and they wanted to raise awareness of different social injustice issues. Another interesting note is that Colin Kaepernick, who kind of got this modern conversation started back in 2016, he called out the NFL yesterday in a tweet, and he said that the actions of the NFL were purely just propaganda. And he said there was a player, Eric Reed, he was a safety, and last year he kneeled. He showed these same things that we're now seeing widespread amongst a lot of athletes, and he's still out of a job. And he was one of the better safeties in the league last year. So
and Kaepernick, of course, still isn't playing.
Yeah, he hasn't played since 2016. So I think that might all factor into him, you know, communicating that he doesn't feel like these are real promises and real change that the NFL is trying to push for.
He sees it as just lip service. That said, it is remarkable how to see that Colin Kaepernick first took a knee about 4 years ago and how far the country and professional sports have moved since then.
Yeah, and the NFL has apologized to Kaepernick, and apparently there's been reports that they've tried to push for a team to sign him. It just hasn't come to fruition just yet.
Well, let's talk about the game now. The Jaguars beat the Colts in their home opener, which was really great to see. We need some good news for a change around here. What were some of the high points of the game?
Yeah, if you're a Jags fan, I think you're happy. It feels perfect how yesterday went on multiple levels. If you look at what a lot of the football experts were saying, the Jaguars were not favored in this matchup. They're not favored in many of the matchups this season. They're largely considered a rebuilding, reforming team. So to come out, and they started a little bit slow, but then they punched Indianapolis right in the mouth, especially in that second half. It was just impressive. And while Gardner Minshew and the offense did great, I really want to commend the defense. That's what impressed me the most yesterday.
Why is that?
Well, you look at, I think it all comes down to the young players. So starting with their top rookies, they got CJ Henderson in the top 10 of the draft last year, and he had some great moments where he got an interception in his first game. He was matched up with the Colts top receiver and was giving him a bit of trouble, especially at the end of the game. The very last play of the game, he was giving him trouble. And then on the offensive side, their rookie wide receiver, Laviska Shenault, had a touchdown, and he really showed some versatility. And then, of course, James Robinson, who is the running back that nobody saw coming. This guy was on the bottom of the depth chart, and he's been called on to replace Leonard Fournette. He played really well, especially in the first half when he was key for setting the pace of the game. But the last person you got to bring up is Gardner Minshew. He played nearly perfect, 95% completion percentage, had three touchdowns. He just didn't make bad decisions during the game. He was just on fire, and there was not one throw that you were thinking, wow, maybe he shouldn't have made that. Every throw he made was on the money.
All right, so a strong start for Minshew. That's great to see. Let's talk college football for a minute. Both Florida State and USF began their seasons this weekend. How is that looking, both in terms of the team's performance and also how they are dealing with the virus?
So FSU played in front of fans in their Saturday opener against Georgia Tech. There's a video that kind of went viral the past few days over the weekend showing a house party at FSU.
Yeah.
There was tons of people congregating, not wearing masks. Let's hope those aren't the same people that went to this game. But either way, it was a disappointing game for the Noles as they suffered a loss to Georgia Tech with head coach Mike Norvell. It was his first game for FSU, and it did not go well. The offense looked really bad. USF didn't play in front of any fans, but they did grab a win. They have a new head coach as well in Jeff Scott. They beat the Citadel, and like I said, there was no fans there, so I guess those are some pretty intense COVID-19 measures.
That's right. Now, over in Gainesville, the Gators don't start their season for a couple more weeks, but their season's getting off to a hot start in more ways than one. There was a fire at the Swamp.
Yes, there is a small fire. Apparently, it was involved with a golf cart at Ben Hill Griffin Stadium in Gainesville. It was causing a lot of smoke buildup in the area. The fire department had to come. It appears everything's okay. There is no significant damage to like the field. It seemed like it was happening near one of the upper levels. But it was a way for the Florida Gators head coach Dan Mullen to tweet out that the Gators are going to be hot this season.
All right, let's talk high school football for a minute. It has returned as well. This video from Baker County went viral last week showing a packed stadium of high school football fans. A lot of concern raised about that. Any changes since that made the rounds?
It doesn't appear that way. It seems a lot of the high schools are taking the "we're always willing to adjust, but nothing just yet." In Baker County, the capacity is at 50%, which of course is different from here, where capacity is at 30% for high school football games. In Clay County, we did see one team, St. John's Country Day, the Spartans. They canceled their season after just one game. They were citing COVID-19 safety concerns and obstacles not making it worth playing the season. We'll see if the events are dangerous over the next couple weeks, since we know that there's delays between testing results as well as, you know, these crowded events. Same thing with the holidays, where we saw, you know, in the last couple months over where people just want to go to the beach, but then we see a spike in testing a couple months after that.
That's right. So for now, anyway, the games are afoot, and it's always good to get your insights. Sky LeBron with us in studio. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And in a moment, how you can see the Jacksonville Symphony this week in concert and in person and for free. And hopefully safely as well. We'll speak with music director Courtney Lewis in just a moment.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Max Mayfield, former director of the National Hurricane Center. This hurricane season, you need to update your family preparedness plan so it includes COVID-19 preparations. So when a storm threatens, be ready to prepare your home and have your family hurricane kit ready. Include supplies for your pets and enough COVID-19 sanitizers, disinfectant wipes, and masks. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org.
With deaths from COVID-19 mounting, Dr. Atul Gawande says it's high time the U.S. deploys a national testing strategy.
This is as big as any casualty situation we've ever had. There is no reason we could not be deploying the dedicated effort to make this work.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, solving the coronavirus test mess this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 here on WJCT News 89.9.
The new book, Florida's Healing Waters, Gilded Age Mineral Springs, Seaside Resorts, and Health Spas, is coming out this month. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with author Rick Kilby. We'll discuss the Miami hurricane of 1926 and the struggle to integrate public schools in Jacksonville. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
Polls suggest most Americans suspect the FDA will cave to political pressure to sign off on a COVID vaccine before Election Day. Commissioner Hahn would like us to think otherwise.
We feel the urgency of the situation at FDA just like everybody else does, but we're not going to cut any corners.
A safe vaccine in time for Christmas? We'll look at those trials still on the list next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. This week, the Jacksonville Symphony will perform two free and open to the public performances in Jacoby Symphony Hall. Now, this will be the first time the hall has been open to the public since March. I spoke about it with conductor and music director Courtney Lewis. Courtney Lewis, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Melissa. It's great to be back with you.
It's so exciting to hear that the Jacksonville Symphony is performing for the public once again in Jacoby Hall. Tell us all about this. What's on the agenda?
So on Wednesday and Thursday of this week, we're having two open house concerts. And these are free concerts at which we're trying out all the new safety protocols that we're putting into place. So the hall will be socially distanced. The orchestra will be socially distanced. Everybody will be wearing masks. And there's a rigorous set of safety protocols that we're putting into place. But these two concerts are going to be, as I said, free. Just have to apply for a ticket. And they're both concerts that reflect the whole range of what we do. So there'll be classical music, there'll be pops. And it's just a really exciting moment for us as we finally return to stage, get back to home, and are able once again to play for the public.
Yeah. Now, you said rigorous protocols. Does that mean that only a certain number of people will be allowed to come into the hall? What are some of the new rules here?
Yep, so the hall capacity is being reduced from 1,800 to just shy of 600, and that allows us to socially distance everybody. The concerts will also, all season long, only be 1 hour long with no intermission. There'll be temperature checks, there'll be obligatory masks, there'll be a great deal of disinfecting and cleaning between every performance. So we're really going out of our way to make sure that our audience feels safe and comfortable.
Sure.
The orchestra itself will also be socially distanced on stage, but up to a maximum of 50 people. So we've redone our whole classical season for a much smaller orchestra so that we can be safe on stage.
Will all of the orchestra and yourself be masked up as you perform?
Yep. And I can't say I'm looking forward to that. But at this point, we're just so excited to get back that, you know, nothing matters as much as not playing music.
Sure. And we all miss live performances so much. So this is really exciting. How does this compare what the Jacksonville Symphony is doing with how other symphony orchestras around the country are edging back into live music and live performance?
We're a little ahead of the curve. We're at an advantage because Jacksonville hasn't had a huge number of cases. And that means that we have a little bit more flexibility. The Dallas Symphony is back, but none of the major symphony orchestras yet are performing. So it's really exciting that we're able to do this for the first time. We'll also be streaming our concert, so I'm hoping that we get a little bit of national attention for being back playing so soon.
Yeah. And are you the impetus behind this? Was this ultimately your call as a music director? How was this decision made?
No, it was made by the staff. So our CEO worked in consultation with the musicians' union to make sure that they were comfortable. We also ran a very significant survey of our audience, and we found that roughly a third of our audience is comfortable coming back. A third haven't decided, and a third want to wait until there's a vaccine. So that actually works out pretty well. If the third who want to come back do come back, we'll sell out because we're at a third of capacity of the hall anyway. So we spent an awful lot of time looking at safety protocols from other organizations, other performing arts organizations around the world and around the country. And we feel confident that we've come up with something which is really going to work.
And, you know, it's been, what, 6 months now since we've been able to go to hear a band, hear the symphony, go to a play, any kind of live venue. It's psychologically tough for the performers, the musicians, and for the public. This is something I think people have missed almost more than anything else, this aspect of our culture. So what do you think this will do for your audience and for your orchestra to just to be able to do this again?
Well, as a musician myself, the last 6 months have been very stressful because we haven't been able to perform. And, you know, you feel a little pointless when you can't do your job all the time. Mm-hmm. So we are tremendously excited to be back. I know that the orchestra, every musician is just dying to be able to perform again. And I second what you just said. I've had a lot of contact from audience members who really miss the orchestra and maybe didn't realize just how much they relied on live performance as a way of elevating their life. So it's going to be great to be able to do what we're supposed to. And I can't wait to see the audience again. I mean, it's going to be so exciting walking out on stage for the first time.
Oh, sure.
After all this time.
And they'll be excited to see you and all of the musicians. So people can, again, this is free, open to the public, but people do need to get a ticket. Is that right? At your website?
That's right. On the website, Wednesday and Thursday of this week. Then September 26th, the week after, we open our real season. So we open with fanfare. And we'll be having the spectacular violinist, James Ennis, who lives in Orlando. So we found a local soloist. He's able to just drive up to avoid any of the quarantining. And that program will feature Beethoven's Symphony.
Okay. And so go to jacksymphony.org for two free open to the public performances this week on Wednesday and Thursday in Jacoby Symphony Hall. Music director and conductor Courtney Lewis, have a great time.
Thank you.
Enjoy the music, everyone, and that's our show. Thanks for listening, and to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. He's pretty happy about that Jaguars win. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep your feedback coming. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. You can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, or our podcast will be up later today. Have a great Monday. We'll connect with you again at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO. Baptist